This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It is episode 48. Not many more. Got to figure out what to do for episode 52, or I need to stop talking about it, because if I keep talking about it and don't do something special for episode 52, that's going to be a letdown. So I don't know what I'm doing. I kind of like the idea of having my first guest commentary on episode 52. I'm not sure who I would have come do that with me. I would have to think about that. Anyways, been a good week. It is Thursday today. I'll probably come in for a couple of more hours. We are in the midst of doing a proposal for a major change in how we go about talking about funds and those kinds of things. And there's a position paper that needs to be written so it can be passed on up the line. And since we're in kind of a hurry for it, I may come in tomorrow for a couple of hours and try to get that going. But all in all, it's been a great week. As you may recall from last episode, I had a scheduled appointment on Monday to go speak at my alma mater, and I did do that. It was fun. I had probably 25 people in the room, somewhere around there, some students, some visiting high school students, and some of the faculty were there, and I think an enjoyable time was had by all. At least I hope so. At least I had fun, let's put it that way. And I did do the thing where I just talked for a little bit, and then we did some questions and answers, and I gave away the last few copies, the beta copies that I had of Amanda and the Scleberry Tree, so that all went well. Speaking of Amanda and the Scleberry Tree, the beta readers are reading, and I'm getting some very nice comments, a lot of people liking it, so that's good. It's been fun this time, too, because since it's a children's book, I not only have parents reading, but the parents are handing off to their kids for them to read it to get me some more feedback, and so that's very cool. It'll be interesting to get all that together. There's another week and a half or so for that input to come in, and so I'm working on some other things while I'm waiting for that. I am still working on my 21-day challenge to go 21 days without complaining, gossiping, or criticizing with no grace. You may recall that I did it with a little grace, and now we're trying to get through it with no grace. I have to say, I had a really close call this morning, and I think I'm okay. Sometimes it's hard to know what's really a criticism and what's just plain a true observation. And I had made a true observation about human nature, and I had a fleeting thought about, okay, was that a criticism? And I thought, no, so I think we're okay. Anyways, it's been a little bit of a lean week this week in terms of fellowshipping. My Tuesday morning canceled, I think. And my Tuesday evening canceled. They both had other things they needed to do with family. I had a good talk with my buddy on Wednesday night. My Thursday evening canceled as well, so I'm going home a little bit early, which is fine because I'm working on a project. That maybe if I actually get it all put together, I'll tell you about it, but it's a super secret project at this point. So I basically have only had a chance to kind of chat with a couple of people about this, where normally I have, you know, the ability to do more, but that's okay. I'll just run it by you all, and you all can think about it and see what you think about all this. I would like today to talk about the machine. In fact, this is a theme in Amanda and the Scleberry Tree, the machine. And as we go along, you'll understand what I mean by that phrase. Many years ago, when I was doing the Nitpicker's Guides, I would go to Star Trek conventions and speak, and it was a blast. We had lots of fun. I have to tell you, in the beginning, when I was getting ready to go to Star Trek conventions, I had some fear and trepidation, because I wasn't sure how the fans at Star Trek conventions would take my Nitpicker's Guide for Next Generation Trekkers. And I was wondering if perhaps I would get, you know, like a Klingon Batleth or something in the back as soon as I walked in and they found out who I was. Thankfully, as soon as I started going to Star Trek conventions, I found the complete opposite reaction. In fact, I was heartily embraced. And I think one of the reasons I was heartily embraced is because they didn't have to hear me talk for very long before they came to the conclusion that, in fact, I was a fan. And I was a fanatic enough fan, I had actually seen the episodes 4, 5, 6 times apiece. To the point that I could almost quote dialogue from the first 4 seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation. And I think that gave me some credibility. And so when I would talk about Star Trek, I could speak authoritatively, and I was doing so from a very lighthearted and fun perspective. In case you don't know, I made my living for 5 years by watching TV and writing down the things they did wrong. So anyways, okay, so I was at a Star Trek convention. John DeLancey was at this Star Trek convention. For those of you who don't know, he played a character called Q, only known by the single letter Q. And Q was a nearly omnipotent being, at least with regards to our existence, who would appear from time to time to taunt Jean-Luc Picard and the crew of the starship Enterprise with the foibles of humanity. And I was at a Star Trek convention, and John DeLancey, who played Q, was there and taking questions from the audience, and I think I had already done my presentation. Probably that's true, because normally they leave the stars' presentations until last, because that's what everybody comes from. And someone asked him a question from the audience. And they said, if you had the power of Q, what is the one thing that you would do? And without batting an eye, he shot back, I would eradicate organized religion from the face of the earth, because when you learn anything about organized religion, you're going to quickly find out how much evil it has perpetrated on the earth and how terrible the earth and our living has become because of organized religion. So I would just get rid of organized religion. I thought, well, okay, I guess we know how he feels about organized religion. And I have heard those kind of comments coming from a wide variety of individuals all my life. Well, if we could just get rid of organized religion, life would be better, because look at the abuses that it's caused. And certainly I am not one to defend the abuses that have been caused by organized religion. There is no questions. They are many and pervasive. This last week, working on my super secret project that I'm working on, I actually swung by the $5 movie bin at Walmart because I wanted something to watch while I was working on it in the evenings, and picked up the movie Elizabeth, which really is it, the costuming and the acting, and the, I mean, it is beautiful. It is a beautiful, beautiful movie. I really enjoyed it. But it made no bones of trumpeting the types of things that supposedly were going on at that time in the religiously motivated, I should say, politics of the Roman Catholic Church against Elizabeth, Queen of England, and her establishing her own church. And certainly I know enough about church history to realize that the Inquisition was a horrible thing. And certainly I know enough about history to realize that many, many, many of the conflicts that we have experienced and are experiencing are, at least on the surface, motivated by religion. However, I don't think you have to look very far to see other organized entities that have the same types of problems. When John Delancey was talking about organized religion being the greatest problem in the world, my thought immediately went to the organized entertainment industry. And I think we would be hard-pressed to believe that it has been a paragon of virtue. And certainly, it has abused what relatively little power it has, at least relative in regards to the type of power that organized religion has. And yet, where it does have power, I don't think it would be very hard for us to figure out how organized entertainment has abused that power. Certainly, it wouldn't be very hard for us to point to what is done to starlets and young actors coming up through the system and what they are subjected to in their working conditions. And if we wanted to take a step back and look at organized politics, I think we would find that in organized politics, there are abuses in terms of waste and fraud and men in high office taking sexual favors from young interns. What's that all about? It's all about abuse of power. And certainly, if we would look at organized business, we would find our share of abuses. I'm presently reading a book called Fast Food Nation. It is based, it is the basis for the movie Food Inc., Food Incorporated. And I would encourage you, if you don't necessarily want to read the whole book, that you would at least go out and rent the movie Food Inc. It's an eye-opener. The book Fast Food Nation goes into much greater depth, and it covers the fast food industry in America and the changes that the fast food industry has brought to the American business landscape. And it really all comes back to a very fundamental idea. And the idea, as I understand it from the book, really originated within the food industry with McDonald's, the McDonald's brothers. One of the things that in the general industry Henry Ford, I think, introduced was the idea of the assembly line, that you could make things cheaper by putting things on an assembly line. And the McDonald's brothers brought that concept to their restaurant. In addition, they brought a concept of using unskilled workers. So up to this time, you might have some kind of a short order cook, and he would cook pretty much anything, whatever you order, you know, he knew what to do, he'd just go ahead and he'd cook it. And that is a somewhat skilled position because you have many, many different types of things that can be ordered. The McDonald's philosophy is, let's not do that. Let's take all the tasks that we have to do in our restaurant and let's break them down into very simple individual jobs. Let's make them jobs that we can train people very quickly how to do them, and then we'll just stick this person in front of this job and have them do this same job over and over and over and over again, day in and day out. And if that person leaves, we won't care. We'll just grab somebody else and plug them in there because it's very simple for them to do this job. What that allowed McDonald's to do was to push down their wage costs because they could go after young people and young adults to work at their restaurant. And if somebody didn't want to work there and moved on, they could just go get another young person. In other words, their concept of workers in their restaurants was not of a multi-skilled worker, but it was of a single-skilled worker doing one job over and over and over and over. Sort of like a little cog in a machine. Well, what's interesting, as McDonald's began to be franchised and more restaurants adopted this model, fast food restaurants, everything became pushed tighter and tighter and tighter to conformity, so that everything became a machine. Everything was built the same way. Everything was prepared the same way. Everybody did the same kind of jobs. And the whole idea was for efficiency. And this concept has spread throughout the entire supply, not only throughout the entire fast food industry, but throughout the entire supplies industry that feeds the fast food industry, to the point that, wow, you read through some of this stuff that's going on, and you just think, ah. I mean, one of the things that really struck me, and I'm not going to tell you about the whole book, because A, I'm not done with the book, and then B, if you're interested, you should go read the book yourself. But there were just a couple of things that really struck me in all this. And most egregious to me, and I haven't finished reading the book yet, so there may be things that are worse, but at this point, most egregious to me in this whole machine that is the fast food industry is the way the meat packing plants, the meat processing plants, deal with their workers. They have a very high turnover rate in these plants, and they don't care. And the reason they don't care is they actually have a financial incentive to have a high turnover rate, because they don't start paying health benefits on these workers till they're worked for them for something like 6 weeks. There's not even a chance for these workers to sign up for health care for that long. They don't have to start paying vacation on them till they've been there for whatever, 6 months or a year. And so if the workers come in and then quit before that time, it really doesn't bother these companies at all, because they're just like, well, that's less money we have to pay. So they're more than happy to have these jobs broken down into very short jobs and to put people in work conditions that will make them quit. And they're more than happy to go out and do recruiting in some of the poorest areas and even haul these people across the country, knowing that the working conditions are going to be far worse than these people are imagining, and knowing that in all likelihood these people are going to get moved across the country, and then they're only going to work for a month, month and a half, and then they're going to quit. In addition to that, there has been things are arranged so that some of the jobs inside these plants are extremely dangerous. And the author tells the stories about the cleaning crews that technically don't work for the meat packing plants, wink, wink. Technically, they're independent operators. And they have to go into these plants where 3,000 to 4,000 cows, I think that's the number, have been killed on any given day. And they have to go in and clean up these plants and get them ready for the next day. And they send these workers into these plants with these pressure hoses that are firing heated water plus chlorine, and the water is heated at something like 180 degrees, and all the machines are running so that they can spray into all the moving parts and get them cleaned out. And to hear the author tell it, in no time, this temperature inside the plant raises to 100 degrees, of course, very high humidity, and the chlorinated water forms a fog inside these plants, so you really can't see what you're doing, But all of these meat packing machines are going, and people get killed inside these plants. And it's, I mean, you think about people trying to work in those conditions, and it's just unbelievable that this is going on. But it is the machine. I happen to be looking for some extra entertainment as I was working on my super secret project this week. And my wife had thought she was taping Medium, but in fact ended up taping Undercover Boss. And it was interesting enough that I went ahead and taped the next one as well. And Undercover Boss, the first episode I watched, was on waste management. And this guy, who's the CEO, he changes out of his clothes and goes down, and he actually works at the entry-level jobs. I'm getting my mail. One moment. He's working at the entry-level jobs, and he's getting an eye-opener. And one of the things that he finds that is just amazing to him is some of these productivity improvements, quote-unquote, that he has put in these targets for productivity are resulting in middle-level managers doing things that he never imagined. Like if you're 1 minute late clocking back in, you get docked 2 minutes of pay. And he's and their female employees who are driving the garbage trucks are on such a tight schedule that they can't even stop and go to the bathroom, and so they take a can around with them. I mean, he's just aghast that this stuff is going on because he seems like a perfectly nice individual. And yet he's looking at what's happening in his company and realizing that some of the very targets, I'm backing into my garage, some of the very targets that he has put in place to help with productivity have in fact resulted in the employees of his company being treated far worse than he ever intended, because that's the way the machine works. The next episode of Undercover Boss was the guy who's in charge of Hooters, and he was trying to figure out how to sort of expand the customer base of Hooters and some of these things, and so he ended up going to a lot of the restaurants and those kinds of things. He ends up at this one restaurant where there is this real go-getter manager, and he's playing games with his waitresses. Where he's saying, well, I know some of you want to go home. Well, okay, you're going to have to play my reindeer games. And he's putting plates of baked beans in front of them and making them put their hands behind their back and slurp up these baked beans, and whoever gets finished first, well, they can go home. And this CEO is aghast at this because he has no idea that, in fact, in this monstrous organization that he's running, that this kind of stuff is going on. Because once he actually sees the machine in operation, he doesn't like it. So here we have organized religion that abuses its power. We have organized government that abuses its power. We have organized entertainment industry that abuses its power. We have organized business that abuses its power. What is the problem here? It's not religion or entertainment or business or government. It's that word in front of it. It's organized. That's where the problem is. Now you're saying, wait, there's nothing wrong with organization. No, there isn't anything wrong with organization. And I have worked with organizations and I have worked in organizations. But what we have to recognize is that any time that you get a collection of human beings into a hierarchical structure where some people have power over other people's, that structure is rife and ready for abuse because the flesh comes to the top. And especially if the structure is dedicated to productivity, especially if the structure has these goals and we have to get to these goals, these goals are the most important thing that we're going to get to. Whenever you have those kinds of attitudes and things going on, it just sets everything up for abuse of power. Because within that, we begin to conceptualize of others as a means to an end, as a cog in the machine. And as soon as someone starts becoming a cog in the machine and we start treating them as a cog in the machine, we begin to treat them as an object and not as a human being. And if they're an object, they have no rights and we don't have to be concerned about them. And they're just there to get the job done so that we can make more money. And then you start to have this abuse of power start to come to the forefront. Because then what the flesh will start convincing is it really doesn't matter how you treat them because they're just objects. They're not really humans. Now then, is there anything that I can do as a crusader to go out and stop the government from abusing people? No. Is there anything I can do as a crusader to go out and stop businesses from abusing people? You know, not really. I mean, honestly, I might be able to go and campaign against one industry and get some things changed, but not really. And lest we forget, there is also organized labor, which, of course, if you look under the surface, you find there's some abuse of power there, too, because it's a hierarchy. Anytime you get humans in a hierarchy, it is very easy for it to fall into abuse of power. It doesn't have to happen, but the flesh is always there and will always drive that down. So what can we do as individuals? As an individual, here's what I try to do. The first thing I usually do is to keep my ties loose to hierarchies. Is first of all, recognize that for me, if I'm bound into a hierarchy, that there's a good chance that there may be some abuse of power that will be going on, and I do not put myself at the mercy of those who might abuse their power, if at all possible. I just go in, I do my job. If someone comes up to me and goes, you know, we got to get that done, I'll tell them, well, everything takes time, money, and processing power and memory. How would you like me to handle this? If you like me to come in and work a little extra, I certainly can do that. But once that breaks over into creating an environment of failure for me, I just tell people, you know, I'd really like to help you out there, but I do have some other things on my schedule and I need to do those things. And I understand that some will say, well, but I can't afford to lose this job. Well, how do you know that? What are you afraid of? Do you really believe that God isn't going to take care of you? And you might find that by being a good worker and giving a little pushback, that they might keep you on because there's a shortage of quality workmanship in the world. The other thing that I think is really important that we can do as individuals is not only guard ourselves from being used as cogs in machines, but we need to also make a very concerted effort at whatever strata of power we are to make sure that we do not treat others as cogs in a machine. I think that's really, really important. That no matter where we are in life and what we're doing in life, I think it's really important to understand that the others around us are human beings and they deserve to be treated like human beings and appreciated. I've been sitting in my garage for a long time, but let me just give you two examples. One of them, I've said over and over and over again, when we go out to eat at restaurants, anytime a server stops by the table and does anything, they get a thank you. Period. If they come pick up a plate, thank you. Doesn't matter what I'm talking about, what's going on at the table, the server puts their hands on fills up a glass, thank you. Comes by to check on us, thank you. They always get a thank you. Always acknowledge that they are there and that they are a human being and you appreciate the kindness that they're showing you. And always tip well. Okay. Always tip well. 20%. At least. There was another incident, though, that happened just a few days ago. We have a janitor that helps out occasionally when our main house cleaning person is not there. And it was really interesting. The first time he came by, I think he's a grad student. I'm pretty sure he's going to a graduate college here in town, and he's working on that. And part of the way he's putting himself through is he's working on the cleaning crews there at headquarters. We have many who are in that situation. They need a part-time job. It's a great part-time job in the evening. And the first time he came through, I did the same thing I always do. I picked up my garbage can and handed it to him so that he wouldn't have to bend over and get it. And when he handed it back to me, I said, thank you very much. And he said, yeah, sure, no problem. And he went on. But you could tell there was a great deal of reservation in him. Some people say, talk to you, and you can tell there's a wall there. And then other people are very open. And for some time, as I would greet this individual, there was a wall. But you know, this last time that he came through, that wall's gradually been dissolving. And this last time he came through, and I handed him my garbage can, I said, thank you, sir, very much. And he handed it back to me, and we chatted for a little while, and you could tell that wall was gone. Because he recognized that I saw him as an individual and as a human being. And I think that's how we should treat everyone around us. And frankly, if all of us would do that, the machine would dissolve on its own. Now, it's not going to because of the flesh, which of course is a part of human nature, and because of the way hierarchies work. But I would just encourage you today to do your little part. Everyone that you encounter, make sure that you acknowledge their existence and that you greet them and thank them if they're doing something for you. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.